According to a recent survey commissioned by the Association of American Universities, one in four women experience sexual assault on college campuses. Our next guest was the one in four. On her second night away at college, she was raped by a fellow student. The university determined that there was no conclusive evidence she'd been raped and, in a matter of months, allowed her rapist to move into the same dormitory where she lived.
To find her own power and strength and prove that she could take care of herself, she decided to drop out of school and hike the Pacific Crest Trail, which begins in Mexico and ends in Canada.
She tells the story of that journey and what it meant to her as a rape survivor in the book Girl in the Woods. Aspen Mattis joins us now. Aspen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before you went on your kind of epic hike along the Pacific Crest Trail, you talked to your parents, and your dad, at one point he says to you something like, what do you think is going to happen? Sort of, what do you want to come out of this? And one of the things you said was that you wanted to feel powerful. Why did you think that, hiking the Pacific Crest Trail would do that for you?
Well, I think there were a few reasons. One was that I'd always really felt like I wasn't capable of taking good care of myself in, like, the world and feeling safe in the world, in the body that I had to live in, like getting to places on time, having my word be heard and audible and respected. And I think the rape really, really, in my vision, confirmed that. I thought it was sort of, in my 18-year-old mind, it was sort of confirmation that I had poor judgment and that, like, how could I have trusted a rapist, and I wasn't capable of functioning on my own in the world. And I saw the trail as a place where I would be forced to rise to the occasion. I would have to prove again and again that I was capable of taking care of myself and prove that to myself if I was going to survive. So it was like, if I could survive there, if I could take good care of myself in the desert, in the Mojave Desert, in the High Sierra, in, like, the Cascade Mountains alone, then I could take care of myself and be okay anywhere.
And you wanted to hike because you had been raped your second night at college. This was at Colorado College. You were from the East Coast. It was a new town in many, many senses. And this changed everything for you. What happened?
Yeah. On my second night of my freshman year at college, before classes had begun, before I had, like, removed my colorful construction paper name tag from my dorm room door, I was raped by another freshman. And I reported the rape to the college, and I went through. The college encouraged me not to. They told me that if I reported the rape to the police, I'd waited too long. I'd waited 2 weeks, and it was too late to conduct a rape kit, so I would have no evidence, so nothing would really come of it. So I went to the school's rape response coordinator, and I remember at the time it totally blew my mind that a tiny little campus of 2,000 kids would even need a rape response coordinator as a full-time position. Like, I didn't think that rape could possibly be common.
And what kind
of retrospect, I know now that it's incredibly common.
What kind of response did you get there from the rape counselor?
Well, so she was, like, I think, a very kind woman in a profoundly dysfunctional, broken system that doesn't want justice. It actually, I think colleges have brands, and they put a lot of money into the creation and protection of their brands. And the last thing that a college wants is a rape conviction on campus. And so it's therefore not in the best interest of the college to have the truth come out. And so there's a system in place. They encouraged me to go through the school's conflict mediation process as if rape could be mediated, like a playground fight. And they really treated it like something we had both done wrong. And I testified, and he testified. And the mediator concluded that the findings were inconclusive, and which is essentially, effectively, they concluded that he was innocent, which meant that I was guilty of lying. And then they allowed him to remain on campus.
We're talking with Aspen Mattis right now. She's the author of Girl in the Woods. It's a memoir of her 2,000-mile trek along the Pacific Crest Trail in the aftermath of a rape. And Aspen, you said initially that one of the things you wanted on the trail, you wanted to feel powerful. And here you are on this trail, you're hiking thousands of miles, and you're there are a lot of men on the trail. The ratio of men to women is something like 5 to 1. You're in threatening situations from nature and from other people at some points. Did you have that feeling of power that you were looking for? Did you find it?
Yeah, in waves and in moments. The trail really tested me and forced me to find my power. It kind of left me with no option other than to rise to the occasion. Like, as you said, that's such a tremendous observation. There were so many more men on this trail than women, so I'd really fled this, like, kind of world of college where there's, like, one girl to every guy and in very close quarters, into the woods and into the desert, a girl among men. And, like, they say, instead of beer goggles, it's trail goggles. And so I was constantly put in the position of making my boundaries clear and saying no, really, like, no, I'm not interested when something felt wrong for me, and saying no without apology. And again and again and again, I found that my voice was audible, that people respected it, that if I said I didn't want to do something, people would not try to make me do that thing. And that was so empowering. Like, confronting your fears is so empowering, especially when, in this case, like, it's just a very specific sort of form of immersion therapy. Like, I'm not it's confronting the thing that bit me, the thing that scared me and hurt me, and that, you know, that left me feeling powerless, and I'm conquering it again and again and again on a daily basis. I'm finding water for myself. I'm navigating. I'm pitching my tent every night and putting sunscreen on my face every morning and staying hydrated and hiking like 26 miles on average every day, like a literal marathon a day, every day with a backpack on, and proving my strength and proving my strength and proving my strength to myself until it was undeniable to myself and I'd really earned my own respect.
In terms of recovering from the rape itself, I don't know if you ever completely recover or if it's just something you carry with you. It's probably individual for all people, but was there a moment when you felt freed of it?
I think there was a moment when it became smaller, and that was the moment when, it wasn't actually a moment, it was like a series of moments when in strength, when I was feeling so strong in myself, and someone would ask me the most common question on the trail among thru-hikers, among the people who are walking the whole trail, this whole way from Mexico all the way to Canada, the most common question was, why are you doing this? Like, what's your reason? Because we all had reasons, and sometimes it wasn't that overt, but people would try to feel it out. They would want to know if you had just lost your job, or if you were trying to quit an addiction, or if you had just been dumped, you know, because I don't think anyone decides to be homeless for 5.5 to 6 months and sleep in a tent in the dirt and deprive themselves of watermelon and plumbing if they're super happy with their lives in the real world. And so in the moments when I felt kind of, as you call it, not healed, but strong again and sort of and less in the shadow of my rape and less like cramped by it were the moments when I had already sort of earned my respect for myself by taking good care, and then someone would ask me why I was walking, what my reason was, and I would tell them the truth. And I think calling a rape, calling a spade, makes it something outside of you. Like, the rape is the terrible, disgusting, horrible, dirty thing, not me. And it kind of shrinks it. It puts it in its place. It's not, I shouldn't feel ashamed, not shame on me, shame on him. And it really, telling the truth always clarifies things, whether it be in writing or to a friend, laying down the facts. It didn't allow me to fester in this confusion of my mind when I was in silence, because I knew I felt like disgusting and ashamed, and I felt those emotions couldn't possibly be anything guilty, and I thought they couldn't be invalid because I felt them so intensely, but that's actually wrong. They were valid. They were the product of a flawed story I was telling myself, and telling the truth about what had happened to me, and speaking openly and freely and honestly about my second night at college made it just one night. I didn't have to carry it like a secret, because secrets become lies, and lies consume us, and speaking something makes it so much less less consuming. You literally let it out.
Well, Aspen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Aspen Mattis is at work on a novel. Her new memoir is called Girl in the Woods. She's donating 5% of her book proceeds to the group RAIN, Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. The group's 24-hour hotline helped her after her rape in 2008.
We just heard the story of rape survivor Aspen Mattis, who hiked the Pacific Crest Trail in the aftermath of her sexual assault. The hike, she says, helped her with personal empowerment and recovery.
Jamie Sathasivam is the program director of the Rape Crisis Center in Madison, and she joins us now to talk about that recovery process and what it can be like. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So we're hearing statistics gathered from college campuses about how 1 in 4 women experience sexual assault on college campuses, and rape, of course, a reality in the non-college world, too. What do you want survivors to know about what that healing process can be like afterwards?
Sure. So the healing process is so individual. Some people, it's really about taking back that power and control. And for Aspen, it sounds like that was really something that resonated with her. She needed to go out, take control of her life, be able to empower herself and do what felt right for her instead of sort of sticking through school. And that's to be credited. For some people, it's receiving counseling. Some want to report to law enforcement, some don't. And all of that is fine. It's about empowering the survivor to take control back in their own life. And that's what we do at RCC. We very much advocate for survivors to choose their healing path.
And obviously, hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, I think it took her 5 or 6 months, and not everyone can take 5 or 6 months just to mentally process things. I mean, how do you suggest, or how have you seen people use the time afterwards and how they think about it and how they process?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, again, it's very much dependent on which avenue they decide to pursue. If they decide to pursue the legal process, that can drag out the healing process for quite a long time as they work through all of the legal reports and making its way through the criminal justice system. And for some people, that means that they're going to be sort of stuck in their healing for a while. Some people, it's about doing that so that they can regain control and say that this was not right and I didn't do anything wrong and I need to stand up for myself. So the healing process is so individualized. The length of time is so individualized, but really it's about allowing that survivor to be empowered in whatever choices they make and validating that nothing they did caused this to happen. Doesn't matter what you drink, how much you drink. Having a sexual assault, experiencing a sexual assault is not a natural consequence of drinking. It's not a consequence of wearing a short skirt. And we have to stop associating those two things because it's very damaging to victims.
And how common is that sort of thinking after a sexual assault that, you know, there is some blame mm-hmm. for the victim there. Is that the kind of thing that you see typically?
Absolutely. I mean, I think ask any survivor why they didn't want to come forward and tell their family. They've got those messages in their head already. They're aware of what people are going to think and what people are going to say. They're going to ask those questions, particularly when we're talking about college students. Parents are going to want to know, were you out drinking? Friends are going to want to know, what were you wearing? Why did you go home with that person? Why did you allow them to come back to your dorm? So those messages that I think sort of in our own minds allow us to feel as though, especially as women, that we're safe, also sort of counteract the healing process for survivors because they know that those are the judgments that people are placing on them very unfairly.
So what is the antidote to that for someone? You know, for Aspen, it was this long journey on a trail and just a gradual mental awareness that it was only rapists cause rape, is I think how she writes it in the book. But how do other people get there?
I think there are so many ways. I think starting to have a larger cultural conversation around what is rape culture, what is misogyny, what causes sexual assault, and that's the rapist, right? It's not the alcohol, it's not the whatever the victim is wearing, it's not that they were alone walking at night. It's about the rapist. And how do we empower women to stand together instead of disempowering people so that we divide and conquer and allow sexual assault to be as common as it is? Because I think the statistics of 1 in 4 women before age 18 and 1 in 6 boys before 18 is just horrific. And I don't understand how that number can stand and we don't have conversations daily as a nation about how to stop that.
We're talking right now with Jamie Sathasitham. She is a program director at the Rape Crisis Center in Madison. And we're talking right now about recovery after sexual assault. If you have a story to share or advice to share, you can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And in terms of resources, techniques that may help, what advice would you want to give someone who's listening right now, who's just been through something like this, a sexual assault? What sorts of tools could help?
I would say, I know that it's really hard, but we have a 24-hour helpline. It's available 24/7, 365 days a year, staffed by professionals who are well-trained to be able to support you and start to counteract some of those messages that you may have floating around in your own mind that other people may be giving you. It's available to survivors and support people so that you can learn how to support someone who's just experienced a really devastating, potentially, assault. And so call that number. It's 251-7273, local in Dane County, and find out about the resources, find out about what the options are for your next steps, and then be empowered to take those choices and take those next steps, whatever that may be for you.
So it sounds like it's a very, very individual process, and people may want to know, you know, how long is this going to take? When will I feel better? Yeah. And I'm guessing there is no one answer.
No, I wish I had a magic pill. I wish I had a magic answer to say, well, wait 5 months and you're going to be healed. For some people, it's, you know, weeks, and for some people, it might be years. It's really an individualized journey, and respecting that everyone needs to take the time and space to create that journey is critical.
And if you're a friend or a family member of someone dealing with the aftermath of a sexual assault, what kinds of things do you want them to know about how to be supportive, to offer support?
Yeah, I think the best thing that you can say as a friend or a family member supporting someone else is, thank you for sharing. It's not your fault. I so appreciate that you told me this, and how can I help you? Give them the choice and what the next steps are. I think, especially for parents, it's really easy to get wrapped up in wanting to create justice or to have some follow-through for the perpetrator. But really talk to that victim and find out what they want. And I use the word victim and survivor sort of interchangeably. Victim is a legal term. Survivor is what we use frequently at the office. But so please don't take offense to the word victim. It's really about saying, thank you for sharing. I'm here with you. There's nothing you did to deserve this, and I'm so sorry that happened to you.
And we've been talking about, you just speaking about terminology, we've been using the word healed. I mean, and I've been curious as I talk to Aspen and now to you, is this the sort of thing that most survivors feel, that there's a point at which becomes past tense and you are healed, or is it same sort of thing as with death, where you sort of carry it with you the rest of your life, or is it just both?
I mean, I think it could be both. It depends on the person. What we hear so often from people is that they do heal. It takes time, but that they do heal. And I think for when I go and I tell people what my job is, I'm always hesitant because you get the, ooh, you do that for a living? And there's sort of that like cringe moment. It's like, no, it's hard at times. It's really hard. But for the most part, we get to see survivors move through the process and move back to feeling as though they can take control and be empowered to make this one piece of their life and not their entire life.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us today and talking.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking to Jamie Sathasivam. She's program director at the Right Rape Crisis Center in Madison. We've been talking about recovery from sexual assault.